10, 5, 15 inches. 15 inches, Foster sputtered. Too much clay, the technician repeated. I'm sorry. We should get more dogs here, Foster said to Tatum. More metal detectors, too, and...
Tatum's phone emitted strange static. Tatum glanced at it, shielding the screen against the sun.
What the hell?
He muttered. Something was happening on the video. The walls around Maribel were vibrating, something roaring around her. Sand filtered through the cracks. Maribel screamed uncontrollably. For a second, Tatum's gut sank, and he thought of the physicist's words. Einstein's experiment had a barrel of explosives. The technician let out a curse, looking over Tatum's shoulder. The walls kept vibrating. This wasn't an explosion. This was something else entirely.
What is that? Foster asked. It looks like there's an earthquake in there. Where is she?
Tatum raised his eyes, looking around him. He could see nothing that made that amount of noise and vibration. But Maribel's surroundings were definitely shuddering. Could they be in the wrong place? And then he caught sight of the railroad. His gut sank, and he glanced at the screen. Maribel had been taken weeks ago, but her shirt, though a bit rumpled, didn't seem to look like something that had been worn for more than a few days. Something was smeared around her eyes, and now Tatum knew what it was. Makeup. They had assumed they were looking at a live video the entire time, just like with Nicole Medina. But they weren't.
It's a train, he said numbly. There's a train running above her. She's buried near the tracks. But there's no train here. There was one when the video was taken.
Tatum's heart throbbed.
Back when she was kidnapped. You have the wrong canine handler here, Detective. We need a cadaver dog.
Chapter 44. He leaned back in his chair, smiling. The first article about him open on the browser. Already, questions about his identity were rising in the text. Who was Schrödinger? What was this experiment? The article maintained a hopeful tone. A police source was quoted saying they were fairly certain they knew where the girl was. Perhaps, the article suggested, the girl in the video could supply Schrödinger's real identity. The girl in the video would not be able to supply them with anything. Had anyone figured that out yet? Maybe Zoe Bentley had. He switched tabs, rereading the article that described how she'd caught the strangling undertaker. She was, according to the article, experienced, brilliant, and thorough. And they'd sent her to look for him. He felt a thrill of excitement. They already knew he was someone exceptional. He opened a few more of the local papers and refreshed their pages, waiting for a new article to show up. Soon he had more than 20 open tabs on his browser. One of the tabs began playing an annoying jingle, and for the life of him, he couldn't figure out which one it was. He ended up muting the volume. Another article popped up in a different paper. Parts of it were obviously an unabashed copy-paste job from the first article. Shoddy work. He despised amateurs more than anything else. What about Nicole Medina? Had anyone in the press figured out the connection yet? Nothing in the articles. Maybe one of the readers would. It was an age of crowdsourced information. He browsed the comments, almost instantly regretting it. One commenter claimed the entire thing was made up by the media to distract the general public from what was going on in the Middle East. More comments postulated this was terrifying or horrible and the work of a monster. No one mentioned Nicole Medina, though someone did ask if there was an experiment number one. He sighed. He'd have to wait patiently for an enterprising reporter to make the connection. It would happen soon. He was almost certain of it. Maybe a police source would leak it, or maybe one of the reporters would just do thorough research. By tomorrow, they'd all know there was a serial killer in San Angelo. He went over the websites again, clicking refresh, waiting, eyes skimming the screen impatiently. Nothing. Soon he'd have to leave for work. He'd have to be patient. Switching to the Instagram tab, he scrolled down his feed, a column of girls presenting themselves for his attention. Every now and then he'd pause, examine a girl in the image, hesitating. Would she be the next one? And then she caught his eye. smiling at the camera while lying on the bed, the blanket covering her body. It was Juliet Beach, one of his favorites. "Last morning being 18, she'd written. He switched to her Facebook profile and checked her birthday. September 10th. That was tomorrow. Would she be partying tomorrow night? Of course she would. Experiment number 3. Chapter 45. Officer Victor Finkelstein parked his SUV on the side of the road and opened the back door for Shelley, his four-legged partner. She leaped from the vehicle, wagging her tail, her jaw open in a wide canine grin, tongue lolling, panting hard. He grabbed her water bowl from the vehicle, put it in front of her, and rummaged in the small cooler for the ice-cold bottle of water he'd put there earlier.
"Glad to see you here, Finkelstein,"
someone said behind him. The man mispronounced his name, making it sound like Finkelstein, which Victor was used to by now. It was a sort of well-known joke in the San Angelo Police Department. He could see the humor in his name's similarity to the fictional 19th-century scientist, especially considering what he did for a living. In fact, that was why he called his dog Shelley, a sort of wink-wink, do you get it? Which no one ever did. He glanced over his shoulder. Detective Foster walked over, another man by his side. Both of them seemed sweaty, cranky, and somewhat tired.
"Hey, Detective," Victor said. "We need you by the railroad," Foster said. "A few minutes, Detective. Shelley needs a drink."
Foster nodded irritably, as if he were obliging an unreasonable demand. People who didn't work with dogs didn't understand how it worked. Shelley was not Victor's pet, and she wasn't his damn slave. She was his partner, and Victor always took care to treat her that way, as his equal. Would Foster have looked as impatient if Victor had said that he needed a drink of water? Not likely. He found the bottle, bits of ice still floating in the water inside. He poured half the bottle into Shelley's bowl, and she lapped at it with gusto. Victor took a swig from the bottle himself, capped it, and put it back in the cooler. Then he closed the back of the van and leaned on it, folding his arms. Shelley still lapped at the water. Foster glanced at his phone and cleared his throat.
"If you don't mind."
"In a minute, Detective," Victor said steadily.
"There's no rush. Not if you called us here."
The detective exchanged glances with the man by his side.
"I'm Officer Finkelstein."
Victor extended his hand.
"Agent Gray."
The man took a step forward and shook his hand. He had a firm handshake and a nice, polite smile.
"A fed, huh?"
Shelley raised her head from the bowl and glanced at Victor. She gave her tail a small wag.
"Okay, Detective, lead the way."
The two men led him through a sandy patch of land. To his surprise, Victor saw Jones there. The two handlers rarely worked together. Jones and Buster were called to help the living. If Victor had a small fault, it was that he often felt his and Shelley's work wasn't as appreciated as the rest of the units. Take Jones, for example. The man had been interviewed by local papers half a dozen times at least. People loved those stories. Man's best friend saves two hikers lost in a canyon, or cop and his dog locate missing girl. Pictures with the survivors, flowers, chocolates, Christmas cards every year. Then there were the detection dogs and their yearly moment of glory, photographed by the shipment of cocaine they'd managed to sniff out. But no articles or pictures in the papers for Victor and Shelley. No man's best friend finds decomposing corpse. No handshakes with the chief of police or the mayor. Ah, well, he knew the value of his job. How many parents had received closure thanks to Victor and Shelley? How many murderers had been taken off the streets thanks to evidence the two partners, six legs and a tail between them, had found? Buster barked once as they got closer. Shelley wagged her tail. She wasn't much of a barker, really. Silent and peaceful, like Victor.
"So we think there's a body buried somewhere here?"
Victor asked.
"Agent Gray certainly thinks so,"
Foster said guardedly.
"We think the girl's buried somewhere near the railroad,"
the agent said.
"We don't know exactly how long ago."
Victor nodded.
"Hear that, Shelley? Let's find her."
Shelley glanced at him, her ears perking up, one leg in the air. Then she sniffed the ground tentatively.
"Which way?"
Victor asked Foster.
"Probably west,"
Agent Gray pointed. Victor began to lead Shelley, letting her sniff occasionally. She stopped to pee near a cactus, then kept walking. And then, all of a sudden, she led Victor and not the other way around. pulling hard against her leash, her body tense, nose close to the ground. She led him 5 yards away from the railroad, behind a small knoll, then paused, sniffing around attentively. She scratched the ground a couple of times and gave a tiny whine. Foster and Agent Gray showed up a few seconds later.
Something here, Victor said. A body?
Foster asked. Victor shrugged.
A cadaver. Could be a dead hyena or goat. Could be the girl you're looking for.
Foster sighed heavily.
Let's start digging.
Victor realized that up to that moment, they'd been hoping he'd fail. They'd been hoping the girl might still be alive. He crouched by Shelley and scratched her neck and behind her left ear.
Good girl. You're a good girl.
Shelley gave him her canine grin, tongue lolling. It would have been nice if someone occasionally scratched behind Victor's ear and told him he was a good cop. Chapter 46. Delia sat at the station by one of the desks, staring at the screen. They'd stopped trying to make her leave after she'd nearly clawed one of the detective's eyes out. Instead, they'd given her a place to sit and placed a cup of water on the desk. The video was muted, and Delia didn't try to turn on the sound. She just stared at her daughter's face. They told her they were searching for Maribel, but wouldn't tell her anything else. That Bentley woman spoke in hushed whispers with Detective Lyons, but neither of them had said anything to Delia. She'd never seen her daughter so frightened in her life. Maribel had always been a ferocious kid, even when she was a tiny toddler. Part of Delia's issues with her stemmed from the fact that Maribel was never worried about the repercussions of anything she did. She never cared about punishments or anything else. For Delia, who'd spent her entire childhood terrified of her father's temper, it was incomprehensible. But Maribel was terrified now, and it tore Delia's heart to see it. Behind her, she heard a phone ring.
Hey, Tatum,
Zoe Bentley said. Any news? Delia turned around, looking at her. Bentley's body was tense, her expression focused. Delia tried to read the woman's face. It was like trying to interpret a marble statue. Bentley listened, occasionally emitting one of those vague words that were scattered throughout a conversation. Okay, yes, I see, uh-huh. And then finally, I'll tell her. Bentley's stare met Delia's. She hung up her phone and cleared her throat.
Mrs. Howe.
I'm sorry. They just found your daughter's body. Delia gaped at her, confused, then glanced back at the screen. Maribel still lay there in the darkness, her lips moving slowly, eyes blinking.
But this video.
The video isn't from today. Bentley's voice had no softness in it. We don't know when it was taken, but it's likely that it was soon after your daughter disappeared. Delia turned her focus to Lyons, as if hoping the detective would talk sense into this woman. But the detective just watched Bentley, mouth slightly ajar.
Are you sure?
Delia asked.
There was a girl in Maribel's school that looked almost like her. Maybe it's her. You can't stop searching just because.
The clothes on the body match the clothing in the video. And the shirt is the one she wore on the day she disappeared, Bentley said. We might need you to identify her later, but it's her. She bent across Delia, switching off the screen. Delia gasped and reached out to turn the screen back on. To her surprise, Bentley grabbed her arm, holding her firmly. She was strong, considering her delicate body. Delia tore her wrist away and let out a dismayed sob. Bentley stepped back and folded her arms, her gaze on Delia. Maribel is gone, Bentley said again. Watching this video of her suffering won't bring her back. All it can do is cause you pain, the same as burning your wrist on your gas stove.
If she hadn't left, if she'd only have listened and stayed here, this wouldn't have happened,
Delia mumbled, looking away. She didn't die because she left home, or because she didn't listen. She also didn't die because of anything that you did. Delia flinched, praying the woman would leave her alone, let her be. She died? Because someone killed her. A man who didn't care about you or her. Do you understand that? Bentley knelt beside her. If you want to see your daughter's face, I suggest you look at her pictures, not at the video that a murderer made. Delia ignored her, shut her eyes. Bentley talked some more. Then Lyon said something. After a while, they helped her to her feet. She didn't struggle. Someone asked her if she had someone to be with, if she needed a ride home. She muttered she was fine, that she had a car. She could get home by herself. They let her. The gas stove in her kitchen was only a short drive away. Chapter 47, San Angelo, Texas, Thursday, March 24th, 1994. His favorite table in the school cafeteria was at the far corner, where he had a perfect line of sight. He sat there on his own, as always, sketch pad in hand, scribbling fast, his attention consumed completely. The tater tots, milk, chicken nuggets, and green jello all sat untouched on his tray, forgotten. Deborah Miller was the only person he could see. She sat at her regular table with her friends, five forgettable girls whose names he didn't know. At the moment, she was laughing, palm over her mouth, eyes sparkling, her blonde curls tumbling hypnotically on her shoulders. Her shirt was wide, letting one shoulder peek from it slightly. He was well familiar with that shirt, that shoulder, and her beautiful neck. He sat behind her in math class, mesmerized for the entire lesson by her every movement. His pencil scraped as he drew her hair, those endless waves of curls, as he imagined running his hand through them. He didn't even have to watch her to get it right anymore. Later, at home, he would page through his sketchbook, make corrections, add some color. Deborah was on his mind from the moment he woke up until the minute he fell asleep. And often, she'd appear in his dreams. He hardly noticed the noise. The three boys who were chasing each other between the tables, laughing. One of them, a boy named Alan, swerved just by his table, colliding with him, knocking the sketch pad from his hand.
"Sorry,"
Alan apologized breathlessly.
"I didn't see you."
He didn't answer, his eyes fixed on the sketch pad that lay by Alan's feet. Alan crouched and picked it up, glancing at the sketch.
"Oh, that's really good. You drew that?"
He cleared his throat and held out his hand for the pad. "Yes," he said, his voice barely a whisper.
"You drawing the girls?"
Alan asked playfully as he paged through it with his dirty hands.
"You?"
His voice faded as he took in the images. He flipped a page, and another, and another. His happy smile twisted into a grimace. The spark in his eyes disappeared. His whole expression morphed, overflowing with disgust and horror, as if looking through the sketches, he'd been exposed to something he could never unsee. Alan tossed the sketch pad on the floor and leaned forward.
"Listen to me, you freak."
Alan's voice trembled.
"If I ever catch you near any of the girls in this school, if you even accidentally bump into one, I'll kick the living shit out of you. You got that?"
He nodded, pulse quick, his breath held.
"If I ever see you drawing anything else, I'll kick the living shit out of you. You got that?"
Another nod. Alan turned away, shoulders hunched, and walked away, a slight sway in his steps. He picked up the sketch pad, flipped through it. Fragments of his own sketches caught his gaze. Deborah's beautiful eyes wide with horror as mud was stuffed into her mouth. Her naked body trapped in a cage. That beautiful bare shoulder protruding from the earth as she tried to escape the quickening sand. Chapter 48. Zoe gazed through the passenger window of Lyons's car as they approached the crime scene. The location did not possess the silence and privacy of the first burial site. It was near a highway, and vehicles drove by constantly. There was a trailer park, a gas station, and a bunch of warehouses nearby providing many curious spectators. And to cap it all, the media had gotten hold of the video link, and an enterprising journalist had managed to connect it to the phone call that was allegedly from Maribel to Delia, and to the murder of Nicole Medina. Zoe counted five different media vans, and a sixth one pulled up just as they parked. The officers that had been searching for Maribel Howe all morning were now trying to keep the crowds away using yards of crime scene tape. A large tarp tent had been raised around the gravesite, hiding it from the prying eyes and camera lenses. But Zoe knew that images of this scene would be plastered online that very evening, and they would be linked to the killer's website. There would be endless debate about the ominous, Experiment Number 1 and 2 videos, as well as theories about Experiment Number 3. People would talk about the two Schrodingers, the scientist and the murder. He'd gotten what he was going for. Fame. Harry Berry had called her 3 times in the past hour, and she'd ignored the calls. He was probably furious at the loss of his big scoop, but Zoe couldn't care less. Her sister was being stalked by one killer, while here another killer was accelerating. Should she leave right now and go back to Dale City? Should she stay? Both options seemed equally impossible. She stepped out of the car and into the inferno of the high noon sun. Trying to ignore it, she followed Lyons, who strode toward the throng, homing in on the officer with the clipboard. They both signed their name in the log and moved into the crime scene. Tatum was talking with an officer with a dog on a leash. Zoe walked over, lowering her head against the sun. Tatum turned toward her as she got closer.
How's the mother?
Zoe shook her head.
Not good.
Lyons called someone from the local victims' assistance unit. She still claims her daughter phoned her yesterday.
The killer must have used parts of the video's audio to cobble up a daughter crying for her mother's help,
Tatum said heavily. The police can call off the search in the area where Maribel supposedly called from, since it was the killer's doing. He probably called far from his home to throw us off.
Foster already figured that one out.
What do we have so far? The video is still running?
I talked to Shelton, Tatum said. They're trying to pull the website down, but it's tricky. Host and domain were registered via a check provider.
What about the phone uploading the video? It's here somewhere, right?
We had officers canvassing the entire area with metal detectors, but no luck. Right now, we're trying to search the nearby trailer park, but some inhabitants are making problems. Foster is working on search warrants, but it's a bureaucratic nightmare.
The dog sniffed Zoe's hand tentatively. She pulled it away, annoyed.
This is Victor, the canine officer who located the body,
Tatum said.
It was Shelley who located the body, Victor said. I was just tagging along.
Zoe nodded at him curtly, then turned back to Tatum. Do we have time of death yet?
The Emmy is still in there,
Tatum gestured at the tent.
Feel free to ask him. I saw enough.
Zoe made her way to the tent and lifted the flap. She almost turned around and left as the smell hit her. It was stifling hot inside, and the stench was so thick and sharp it felt malignant. A large rectangular hole was located in the middle of the ground, and one spotlight shone down at it. Zoe took 3 steps forward and saw the doctor's bald head as he crouched by the body. It was horrifically decomposed, bloated and misshapen, patches of black and gray on the skin. One glance was enough for her, and she took a step back to hide the body from her sight. She tried to recall the doctor's name, but all she could think of was his idiotic nickname. Dr. Curly? She said. He raised his head, a face mask hiding his nose and mouth.
Agent Bentley.
Do you have time of death yet?
It's really hard to say. Liquids have been expelled from the body, and there's a buildup of gas, as you can see.
I'll take your word for it.
The body was buried deep in very dry soil, well beyond the reach of insects, so the putrefaction is not as bad as it would be otherwise. I'll be able to give you a good estimate after I check the stage of the internal organs decomposition, but that requires a full autopsy. For now, I can estimate that the victim died at least 2 weeks ago, and no more than 8.
Thanks, Doctor, she blurted and lunged for the flap of the opening. Once outside, she took a deep breath, and that turned out to be a mistake. The tent gave the sense that it contained the smell inside, but in fact, the stench's presence was still very notable, and Zoe had managed to inhale a deep lungful of it. For a moment, it was touch and go, and she almost threw up. But knowing she was being watched, she stumbled a few steps, taking shallow breaths through her nose until her stomach settled. She took out her phone and wrote Andrea a quick message. Everything all right? She watched the 3 dots blinking as Andrea wrote her response. Better. Your chief dropped by today. She's nice. And Marvin is making me his famous hamburgers. Zoe hesitated, then tapped. I missed the flight. There was another murder. Oh, God. That's terrible. I'll get on the next one. They can manage without me. The 3 dots blinked for a long time. Zoe thought that she would get a manifesto as a response. But in the end, Andrea simply wrote, "You can stay another day or two." Zoe imagined her sister writing an answer, deleting it, writing another, deleting again, struggling to decide how she really felt. She pressed her lips tightly and wrote, "We'll talk about it later." Sliding the phone into her pocket, she scrutinized the area, trying to figure out what had made the killer choose this spot. It wasn't as isolated as the first one. Plenty of potential witnesses within 100 yards. Then again, the grave itself was reasonably hidden by a small knoll and a cluster of trees. Though it was close to the highway, it was far enough from it, and there was a road that broke off the highway that he could use to get nearby with a van. It was good, but not good enough. She was missing something important here, and it frustrated her. She saw Lyons talking to a police officer a few yards away, her face animated. The officer was holding an evidence bag with something metallic in it. Lyons took it from him. Zoe hurried over. "What's up?" "They found the phone that's streaming the video. It's not connected to anything. The video is saved on the phone. Damn thing is still streaming." "Where was it?" "It was in the trailer park, in a pile of junk." "The trailer park is fenced, right?" Zoe asked, excitement building. "Did anyone see a stranger drive in?" "No one drove in for anything," Lyons said. "There's an old lady whose trailer is just by the gate. She says she sees everyone coming in or out." "I believe her. She listed all the actions of her neighbors from the past week in a level of detail that makes me think she keeps a log. She didn't see any stranger enter the trailer park in the last 24 hours. Do you think it's possible the killer lives there?" Zoe shook her head. "The killer is careful. He'd never draw us to his doorstep. Maybe he gave it to someone to plant there. Or maybe he just tossed it over the fence. The pile of junk is just a few feet away from the edge of the trailer park." "This is what he wanted all along," Zoe said. "What do you mean?" "He could have streamed this video from anywhere. But not only does he put it here, he uses one of the phones that he used in the previous murder, despite the fact that he'd carefully made sure they were turned off the entire time in between, because he knew we'd be monitoring it and would instantly show up here once the phone was turned on. He's led us here because he wanted us to find the body."
"Why?"
"Because that's the point of experiment number 2. The test subject of his experiment wasn't Maribel Howe. It was us. He wanted to see how we'd react if we assumed the video was live, like the first one was. He's playing with us."
Chapter 49. Tatum watched as Foster interrogated yet another witness from the trailer park. A few of them took affront to the color of Foster's skin. One of them was drunk to the point of slurred, incoherent sentences, and a woman who lived in a ramshackle trailer painted a ghastly pink agreed to answer questions only through a closed door. It was not ideal. The general consensus was that the residents hadn't seen any stranger enter the trailer park for the past 24 hours, and none of them knew where the offending phone had come from. No one had seen anyone dig the pit or place a coffin-sized box in it. In fact, none of them had seen anything interesting, not to mention illegal, ever, since the day they were born. Lucky lot. Two of the residents did point out that there was a suspicious individual living inside the trailer park, right among them. This man could very well be a sinister murder. The residents' names were Howard and Tommy. The suspicious individuals they referred to were, respectively, Tommy and Howard. Further questioning brought up an old grudge between the two, originating in a drill one of them had borrowed and never returned, resulting in an escalating barrage of offenses that no one, not even themselves, could keep track of. Tatum groaned, thrusting his hands in his pockets. It seemed like a pointless waste of time. He considered going to see how the officers talking to the gas station attendants were doing.
"Detective Foster," a female officer called, motioning with her hand. "You'll want to hear this."
Foster approached her.
"What is it, Wilson?"
Tatum moved closer to hear the conversation. The officer had been talking to a young teenager, maybe 16. He mostly talked to the officer's chest, but she didn't seem to mind. She had a certain intensity to her eyes that Tatum knew well. She'd latched on to something good.
"Okay, Paul, tell Detective Foster what you just told me," she said to the boy.
He turned around, clearly miffed about the fact that he now had to address a middle-aged male detective who had nothing going for him in the cleavage department.
"Well,
Like I said, me and Jeff, he don't live here no more because he moved out with his mother because his parents got divorced. So he and his mom moved in with his grandparents down south. We were walking around a while ago. I think it was a year and a half ago. Yeah, definitely a year and a half ago. Because Jeff moved away last summer and it was just before then. I remember he was talking about how his parents were getting a divorce because they were fighting all the time. And we saw this guy.
What guy? Foster asked.
A guy where you built that tent over there. He dug a pit, he had a shovel and a bunch of other tools, and he wore some kind of maintenance suit. But we knew he wasn't maintaining shit because there are no pipes or wires or anything there, right? Jeff's dad used to be a plumber working for the city before he got fired, because he drank all the time, so he knew there was nothing there. Also, this guy didn't look like a plumber.
What did he look like?
I don't know, man. He was white for sure, but we were too far away, and we didn't want to get any closer because we didn't want him to see us.
Why not? The rhythm of the conversation was hypnotic. Foster asking pointed questions fast and short, and the boy answering in long, serpentine sentences, their structure maze-like. Tatum could almost imagine this being a stage act accompanied by the strumming of a single guitar.
Because Jeff said he was someone from the mafia, and that he dug a pit to stash drugs in her money or body. And we didn't want him to see us. We're not idiots. We stayed away, but we were careful to see exactly what he was doing. And this guy dug there all day, like nonstop.
Did you tell your parents? Tell anyone?
Paul seemed to hesitate for a moment and stared down at his shoes, biting his lips.
You didn't want to, Tatum said. Because you were hoping he'd stash money there.
It ain't against the law to say nothing, Paul muttered.
So this guy digs a hole.
Frustration crept into Foster's voice.
Then what?
Then he left. So we waited until it was dark, and we went there because we figured maybe he stashed some money there so we could take some of it. Not too much, you know. Jeff really wanted cash because his dad was unemployed, so he figured he could maybe help out a bit, and I wanted cash because...
He paused. His own motives probably hadn't been as pure as Jeff's.
Because cash is a good thing to have, Tatum said.
Go on. So we go there, and at first we couldn't find the hole, which was weird, man, because why dig a hole if you just fill it up, right?
But after a while, we hear this strange noise, and we notice that the ground is wobbling. It turns out, this guy covered his hole with a few wooden planks, and then he hid them under the sand. So this hole was invisible if you didn't know where to look.
We removed the planks, but we found nothing there. No cash, no drugs. So I said, or maybe it was Jeff. No, it was definitely me. I said, maybe this guy dug the hole, and he intends to use it later, you know? Like a good hiding spot. So we were thinking we'd keep an eye on this hole, maybe see that guy again, and once he puts his stash there, we'll check it out. And if it's cash, we could maybe take some, and if it's drugs, we could, tell the police.
Tatum rolled his eyes. Or steal it and sell it. But this guy never came back, and I checked this damn hole every night for, like, a whole year.
He never put anything there. So I figured he forgot where he put the hole, and Jeff already moved away, and I got kind of tired of going every night to check it. And also, one time a scorpion almost stung me. It ain't fun to wander here at night, you know?
And you never saw that guy again? Foster asked.
Nah, never. I mean, maybe, because I never got a good look at him. So I could have seen him in the street or in the park or behind me at the movies and I wouldn't know. But I never seen the guy come back to his hole. No one ever came to that hole until you lot showed up.
And did you happen to see anything about him? Anything at all?
He drove a white van. Didn't get no license plate or anything, but it was white, and it looked kind of crap.
Tatum and Foster exchanged looks. Finally, something.
Do you know how I can get in touch with Jeff? Foster asked.
Nah, man. He moved somewhere near San Antonio, I think.
We'll find him. And can you tell us anything else about the van? What brand, anything that stood out about it?
It was white, Paul said apologetically. I was mostly paying attention to the hole.
Thanks, Paul. You've been very helpful, Foster said.
The boy nodded and milled around, maybe hoping to talk to Officer Wilson again. But after a while, he must have realized it wasn't in his immediate future and shuffled away.
Could the killer have been planning this thing for a year and a half?
Foster asked Tatum in a low voice. Tatum glanced sideways, seeing Zoe approach them. What's up? She asked.
We have a witness who saw our man dig the hole, Tatum said. A year and a half ago.
She paused, stunned. A year and a half?
He's clearly been planning this for much longer than you thought, Foster said. You were wrong.
Tatum expected Zoe to snap back. You were wrong were not her favorite words to hear, and certainly not in that order. But instead, she just gazed ahead. He knew that look. An idea was taking shape in her mind. Chapter 50 Zoe paced back and forth in the station's meeting room, her mind churning. Tatum sat by the table, chewing a pizza slice. They'd bought a whole pizza on the way, a replacement for both lunch and dinner.
Sit down, he said. Eat. We don't brainstorm on an empty stomach.
She sat down, forgot why she was sitting, and stood up. Sat down again, grabbed a pizza slice. It was topped with grilled ham and pineapple. The pineapple debate was a sore spot between Zoe and her sister, but she was happy to discover that Tatum was not as averse to the idea as Andrea. They'd ordered half with pineapple and ham, and half with pepperoni and hot peppers. She took a bite, making sure it contained both ham and pineapple, and shut her eyes. The ham was grilled to perfection, its edges crispy and the contrast with the pineapple sweetness, the thick layer of mozzarella and the garlicky pizza sauce managed for one blessed second to drive everything else from her mind. She was in pizza nirvana. She was one with the pizza. She chewed carefully and swallowed. When she opened her eyes, Tatum was looking at her, a small smile tugging at the side of his mouth. What? She said, feeling defensive.
It's nice to see you enjoy something for once. It doesn't happen much.
She cleared her throat. It used to be more frequent, before Glover re-entered my life. Before things became so hectic.
Right.
She sighed and checked her phone. She'd talked to Andrea half an hour ago, and her sister had sounded fine. Marvin kept her company. The police watched outside. She felt safe. Still, Zoe wanted to be there. Wanted to hug Andrea, to tell her nothing would happen to her, that her big sister was there for her.
Let's talk about Schrodinger's killer,
Tatum said. Zoe rolled her eyes. The press had nicknamed the killer, and it threatened to stick. Zoe hated this particular nickname because the killer had chosen it for himself. He'd baptized himself Schrodinger, knowing it would end up being his nickname.
Our initial theory seems to be wrong, Tatum said. We assumed he began planning these murders a few months ago, after succumbing to his fantasy for the first time. But it now looks like he's been planning this for years, preparing the graves, planning his websites, stalking potential victims.
No, Zoe interrupted. I stand by my initial assessment. He began planning this whole thing with Schrodinger and the weird experiment a few months ago, after he killed for the first time.
He was seen digging the pit over a year ago.
This guy's sexual fantasy revolves around burying women alive. But he didn't, for years. Instead, he fantasized. And part of his fantasy was digging those pits. He probably dug them imagining he could use them. I'm betting that he'd sometimes masturbate near these pits. He'd leave them covered, knowing he could potentially one day use them. That thought must have excited him.
So you're saying when he dug that pit a year and a half ago, he never planned to really use it?
I'm saying he toyed with the idea. But it was a fantasy. Then a year later, he snapped. Decides to bury his first victim. And he already has pits ready all over the place. All he has to do is choose one. Tatum took a slice of pepperoni pizza.
So why does that help us?
Zoe eyed the pizza box. She still hadn't finished her slice, but Tatum seemed intent on eating just the pepperoni slices, and there was only one left of those. She took a huge bite from her slice, knowing that time was of the essence.
At first,
she said, her mouth full. We thought he'd dig a pit. Kidnap a victim, then bury her in the pit, right? But that's not the case. He already has pits. Dozens of them, probably. All we have to do is find them. Tatum paused, the slice halfway to his mouth.
And we wait for him there. A stakeout.
That's right.
These damn pits could be anywhere.
Not anywhere. She stood up, approaching the map on the wall. She marked a small red X in the spot where they'd found Maribel Howe. This is where Maribel Howe was buried. And this, she pointed at another X that was already there before, is where Nicole was buried. Both are about 4 to 5 miles from San Angelo. A guy gets an urge, he drives a few miles out of the city, digs a pit. So these pits are several miles out of the city, near roads, but hidden enough so he doesn't get interrupted.
That's still a shitload of ground to cover.
Maybe there's a way to locate these holes efficiently. But we need to talk to an expert. Some dirt expert.
You mean a geologist?
Tatum smirked. Whatever. Zoe finished her slice and snatched the last pepperoni slice before Tatum could get to it. The smirk disappeared from his face.
Okay.
Tatum grabbed one of the pineapple slices.
Along with the hotline that Foster started this morning, that's two proactive steps we're taking. I like it.
We know something else about the killer, Zoe said, her tongue starting to prickle from the hot peppers. He stalks the victims. That's almost a certainty. Both Nicole and Maribel were taken when they returned late at night to their homes. The killer waited for them there. He was probably stalking out their homes for days, waiting for an opportunity.
So she'd be someone who wouldn't be easily noticed. Dressed as a maintenance man, like that kid in the park said.
That sounds like the most reasonable conclusion, Zoe agreed.
We can tell Foster. Have the police patrols check out maintenance people working alone. Make sure they're actually working, and take their names. Check the type of van they use. Look into the ones that fit our profile.
Good idea. Number 4. Zoe raised 4 fingers. She huffed heavily through her mouth, trying to get more airflow to soothe the burning. I want to establish a dialogue with the murderer.
Like a public letter in the newspaper? They tried it with the Son of Sam. It didn't work.
The Son of Sam was already talking to them, writing his weird poetic letters. And he wasn't stupid enough to answer directly. He just enjoyed the attention. If we publish a public letter for this killer...
You can call him Schrodinger's killer. I won't judge.
We'll get a similar result. He'd never answer us. He communicates very little as it is.
He isn't communicating with us at all.
He named himself Schrodinger. He's telling us his murders are experiments. And he sends us videos. These are all forms of communication. But he's given them a lot of thought. Made sure to keep them to a minimum. He's careful. We need to establish a mode of communication that would catch him off his guard. That would make him answer impulsively. Tatum frowned.
What do you have in mind?
I want to get an unflattering article published.
Online media is already calling him a maniac and a monster.
He's been expecting that. That wouldn't enrage him. Zoe shook her head. I want to make him sound like a bungling idiot. Maybe we can get him to comment on the article.
That sounds volatile. How do you know he won't react by killing another victim, showing us how capable he is?
He is planning to kill another woman soon. He pretty much told us that with his experiments, Zoe said with certainty. And his murders are well planned and calculated. I believe when we finally find him, we'll see he has a list of potential victims, maybe even dates. He won't change his plan because of us. But with a bit of luck, we can get a gut reaction from him.
You're thinking of using that guy, Harry Berry, right?
Zoe nodded, taking a swig from her Coke can. Coke was by far the most useless liquid when it came to negating spicy foods. Tatum leaned back in his seat.
You don't sound like you're flying home tomorrow morning.
Zoe bit her lip. She still hadn't decided, but Tatum was right. She was thinking and talking about it as if she intended to stay, at least for a day or two more. She felt a stab of guilt. Shouldn't she be with her sister right now? Nothing changed yesterday when Glover showed up, she said. For the past month, I've been feeling as if I was sitting with a wasp in the room. I couldn't see it, but it was there. Tatum looked at her, saying nothing. Glover is the wasp, she clarified.
I got that.
Now I know where he is, and everyone else does too. I've been trying to get Mancuso and Caldwell to take this threat seriously. Now they know I was right. They're watching out for Andrea. And Glover wouldn't attack now. Not when he knows we're watching. He'll wait. He's always been careful and patient. Tatum nodded in agreement. I'm going back as soon as possible, she continued. But Not yet. The San Angelo police isn't equipped to deal with this killer. I'll stay for a day or two more, make sure the investigation is progressing in the right direction, and then I'll fly to be with my sister.
All right, then. There's just one thing you didn't think of.
Zoe tensed. What?
Andrea's with Marvin. That's the real risk. By the time you get back, he's going to drive her insane.
Chapter 51. As soon as Juliet Beach dropped by her parents' home, she saw that they were having one of their nuclear take-no-prisoner arguments. Her brother, Tommy, hid in his room, literally under the blankets. She shut the door to his room behind her, muting her brother's hysterical monologue. Oh, she said. I thought Tommy was here, but I guess he went somewhere. The blob under the blankets shifted. That's too bad, Juliet sighed. I really wanted to go for some ice cream. A sharp intake of breath expelled from the blob. In the background, Mom called Dad a useless bastard. Her parents' fights were the main reason Juliet left home. Though, weirdly enough, when they weren't fighting, they clearly adored each other. Maybe I'll rest a little before I leave, Juliet said. A slight giggle from the blob. She lay down on the bed, squashing the blob with her back. Oh, what is that? She groaned. This bed is so uncomfortable. She shifted, poking the blob, getting another giggle. Beyond the door, Dad's muffled voice called her mom a leech. Lovely. She needed to get out of there, but no way was she leaving Tommy behind. I think maybe this bed needs tickling, she announced, and her fingers went for the blob's soft spots. After 3 seconds, Tommy let out a shriek of laughter, his head poking from the bedsheets, a mass of blonde curls, his eyes crinkling with amusement.
I was here all the time. I was hiding, he said, brimming with joy for outsmarting his sister. You were, Juliet said, shocked. I didn't even see you.
He was smiling at her, his button nose teasing her to kiss it. She grabbed him in a big hug. Want to come for some ice cream? She asked.
Can I get 3 flavors this time?
I'll have to ask the ice cream man if it's allowed.
Okay.
He bounded from bed, already putting on his shoes.
Can I take Ted with me?
Ted was his Darth Vader doll. Juliet used to call it his Teddy Vader, and Tommy, assuming Teddy was the doll's first name, had shortened it to Ted. Sure, but he isn't getting ice cream.
Okay.
Beyond the door, Mom shrieked something unintelligible. Tommy paused, stiffening. They'll stop fighting by the time we get back, Juliet said.
How do you know?
19 years of experience, that was how she knew. These fights were fast and furious, always ending with Mom crying and Dad apologizing. I just do.
Promise?
I promise. Now get Ted. I want my ice cream. He snatched Ted from the bed and was about to open the door. Wait. Juliet took out her phone and knelt by his side. Say ice cream. She raised the phone so that the camera caught them both.
Ice cream!
Chapter 52. Harry sat by the bar, drinking his second Miller and feeling very much like he'd been played. He'd become too sentimental. That was the problem. He'd developed a soft spot for Zoe Bentley, thinking she'd never break her word. He should have known better. Words were just that, words, and they were fragile things, bound to be broken. After all, he'd broken his own promises more times than he could count. And now every damn reporter in the country had the scoop. A serial killer in San Angelo. Tomorrow they'd all write about the FBI presence in the case, and Harry would have absolutely nothing. Zoe had messaged him half an hour ago, asking him to meet. He'd named this place, hoping he could get her drunk enough to let slip a tasty morsel. But now she was late, and he suspected he was being stood up. Oh, sure. He had already written his own article naming both Zoe Bentley and Agent Tatum Gray, referencing the strangling Undertaker case, as well as Zoe's encounter with a serial killer at a young age. But he knew it wasn't enough. It didn't have that extra spice that made an article viral. He scanned the bar. Though it was Friday night, it seemed empty. News about the serial killer was spreading fast. People were scared. A woman slid onto the empty bar stool next to him. Zoe. She raised her hand to draw the barman's attention. A pint of Guinness, please. The barman smiled at her.
That's a serious drink for a woman.
Is it? Zoe held the barman's gaze for a long second. The barman's smile faded, replaced with a perplexed, somewhat intimidated expression. He cleared his throat.
Sure, coming right up.
Harry emptied his own glass.
And I'll have another Miller.
They sat in silence as the barman poured their drinks. Finally, Harry said,
You screwed me.
No, I didn't. Settle down.
You told me you'd have something for me. Now everyone has it.
All they have is a stupid nickname and a bunch of conjectures.
They'll have more tomorrow. Reporters in this town have their sources in the police. You know what I have? Nothing.
The barman placed the drinks in front of them, avoiding Zoe's gaze. Harry almost found it amusing. Zoe took a deep swig from her glass, shutting her eyes, breathing through her nose.
God, I needed that, she muttered.
It's been a very long day.
You want me to feel sorry for you?
I want you to stop bitching for a start, Zoe said sharply. You act like I'm your girlfriend. Let me remind you that you're the reporter that's actively badgering me. Harry grinned at her, cheered up by her annoyed tone of voice.
I'm not badgering you. I'm tailing you from a respectable distance.
You booked a room in my motel.
It's a good motel. It has a nice swimming pool.
Oh, give me a break. She gave him a furious gaze. He raised his glass in a mock toast.
Now who's bitching?
She blinked, then took another sip of her beer. Listen, I want to give you an interview, but you have to publish it tomorrow morning.
I already wrote my story for tomorrow. My editor is working on it right now.
Tell him to trash it. We need a new one.
We.
I'm willing to give you an interview every day. An update on the case. I'll talk to no other reporter. Harry peered at her skeptically.
Why?
I want to catch the killer off balance.
Are you talking about Schrodinger's killer?
That's a dumb nickname.
It's what everyone's calling him,
Harry pointed out, starting to feel anxious.
So, what exactly do you want to do here?
She looked at him thoughtfully. Who in the BAU is your source? Harry leaned back, confused.
What source?
Someone told you I flew here on a case. Who was it? Harry grinned.
Forget it, that's off the table. You should know that. A reporter who gives away his sources is useless.
We'll find him.
I'm sure you will. You're so very clever. Now, we were talking about my daily interview.
Zoe took a swig from her beer, licking the foam off her top lip. I want to make this killer sound incompetent. To prod him, make him lash out. Maybe he'll comment on the article. Do you have data on the people commenting on your articles? IP addresses, that sort of thing? Harry knew exactly how thorough their data was, because he'd tracked down people who'd commented on his articles more than once. It was important to have a well-documented shit list.
Sure, we can get quite a lot from a comment.
Great. Now it was Zoe's turn to get excited. Her eyes sparkled in a way Harry found quite fetching. If he comments, we might be able to track him down.
What makes you think he'll react to the article?
He takes himself very seriously. So you'll interview me, and I'll slip in some details about how he keeps making mistakes. That we'll catch him in no time, that sort of thing. Harry rolled his eyes.
And that'll infuriate him, and make him react.
He won't like how I'm belittling him.
Don't take this the wrong way,
Harry said.
But when it comes to hurting people's feelings, you're like a 6-year-old girl yelling at a boy who pulled her pigtails that he stinks.
Zoe furrowed her brow in annoyance. I'm good at what I do.
You're good at getting into serial killers' minds and understanding the way they tick, no doubt there.
Harry grinned.
But if you need to annoy people, I suggest that you let me take the wheel for a bit.
I suppose I can't argue with that.
What you want to do is compare him to others. People are competitive, men in particular.
Serial killers often relate to other serial killers when talking about their own actions, Zoe said. BTK used to compare himself to the Son of Sam and the Green River Killer.
See? You tell everyone that he sucks and he won't bat an eyelash. But tell people that compared to Manson he's a clown, and this guy will blow a gasket.
That's That's a good idea. So when we talk about it, we'll compare him to some other serial killers. And he'll come up short. That'll get him riled up.
But that's deep in the text, right? We need a headline. A headline sets the tone for the article. The headline can't be, San Angelo Killer isn't as good as Ted Bundy.
Well, no. But I don't think we can really get him annoyed just with a headline.
Can't we?
Harry raised his eyebrow.
He named himself, right? Calls himself Schrodinger?
Yeah, and the press call him Schrodinger's killer. Harry folded his arms, smirking.
The Chicago Daily Gazette might have a different name for him.
Chapter 53. San Angelo, Texas. Saturday, September 10th, 2016. The digging killer strikes twice in San Angelo. He glared at the article in disbelief, his fist spasming. He skimmed the article, feeling his heart pounding. It was one of the most detailed articles he'd found that morning, and while it linked him to both victims and even provided good images from the video clips, there were certain sentences that seared themselves into his retina. Profiler Dr. Zoe Bentley stated that the digging killer is inefficient. Though he dubbed himself Schrodinger, he seemed to have misspelled the name, omitting the umlaut that the original Schrodinger had in his name. When asked if this digging killer is the next Ted Bundy, Dr. Bentley answered, "Not by a long shot." It was worse. This was the only reporter Zoe Bentley had agreed to talk to. As a result, various other articles had quoted this article, and he constantly saw phrases like, "the digging killer," a.k.a. Schrodinger's killer. The new nickname seemed to stick. It was mind-boggling. His eyes watered. He bit the side of his mouth, the taste of blood on his tongue. Before he knew what he was doing, he was already typing furiously, the comment box below the article filling up, a scroll bar appearing as he kept on going, correcting inaccuracies, explaining that Schrodinger was a completely legitimate way to spell the name, warning that by the time he was done, Ted Bundy's body count would seem meager. He paused and pushed his chair away from the computer. Scrutinizing the comment box and the wall of text within, he shook his head. What the hell was wrong with him? Taking a long breath, he browsed back to Juliet Beach's Instagram page. He scrolled through the images he knew so well, scrutinized the new picture Juliet had taken with her brother. He then read a few of the birthday greetings that showed up in the comments, imagined his upcoming evening, feeling the excitement building up in his chest. Slowly, his frustration and anger dissipated. Glancing at the time, he decided he had just long enough to write a short email to the article's reporter. The man's name was H. Barry. The article wasn't badly written. The man had done his research, gotten all the facts right, and managed to snag a good interview. It was a man who was proud of his work. He could relate to that. Locating H. Barry's email, he wrote his reply to the article. He kept reminding himself to be short and concise. It was important to get this right. It was possible, and even likely, that the reporter would publish this email. He had to sound like the man he was. Ted Bundy. By the time he was finished, people wouldn't even remember who that was. Chapter 54. Zoe was relieved to find out there were no morning meetings on Saturday. In fact, the lieutenant hadn't shown up yet, and they could all work efficiently without needing to explain their every action to the annoying man. Foster told her the hotline had begun receiving an endless onslaught of tips ever since the public had found out about the serial killer. Lyons and he were sifting through the call logs, determining what was relevant. Foster also had a long list of people he needed to interview,